Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund level intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research, and today we're excited to have another special guest interview. We're joined by Rich Hill of Cohen & Steers. Rich is a Senior Vice President and Head of Real Estate Strategy and Research. He's responsible for identifying allocation opportunities in both listed and private real estate and related thematic and strategic research. Prior to joining the firm in 2022, Mr. Hill was a managing director and head of commercial real estate research at Morgan Stanley, where he was responsible for public REIT equity research, CRE debt strategy, and macro property research. Previously, he was director at RBS Securities and a vice president of Bank of America Corporation. Mr. Hill has a BS from Georgetown University and is based in New York. Rich, thank you so much for joining us. And Omar, I'll turn it to you to get us kicked off.
Rich, it is an absolute privilege to have you with us today and talk real estate. You've spent many years in commercial real estate finance and covering the space and really played many roles across some of the largest and most well-known institutions. But I'd love to get a little bit more background about how you got into real estate in the first place. Would you be willing to share with us what turned you on to real estate originally?
Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me on, guys. It's great to see both of you today. So look, I grew up in a real estate family. My dad was a mall manager. I like to joke and tell people that does not mean my family owned malls. That means he managed malls for people that own malls, which means that he was basically one step up from the janitor. I had no desire to get back into commercial real estate, not exactly what most 21, 22-year-olds aspire to be when they're graduating college. But as luck would have it, when I joined Bank of America out of college, I was put on the interest rate derivatives desk covering commercial real estate developers and home builders. So what did I do there? I basically hedged commercial real estate owners' interest rate risk when they were taking out loans. I did that for 3 years, then moved over to the debt capital markets side of the business where I was working on securitizations of commercial real estate loans. Great business, had a ton of fun. And then 2008 hit like a shovel in the face. I recreated myself as a research analyst, first on the debt side of the business at Royal Bank of Scotland, joined Morgan Stanley in 2013 to rebuild CMBS research, macro property research, CRE debt research, and then ultimately took over REIT equity research as well. Before I left Morgan Stanley, I was the only person on Wall Street covering what I refer to as the horizontal and vertical of commercial real estate. Listed REITs from a stock picking perspective, CRE debt strategy, and macro property research. I joke that meant I was a bottoms-up analyst, a top-down strategist, and sometimes I played an economist on TV. So I joined Cohen & Steers almost 2 years ago to the day in a newly created role as head of strategy and research for real estate, sitting between our public and private teams. I threw a lot at you in a very short period of time. I'm going to stay on my soapbox for a second, but I'm going to pause here and see what other questions you might have.
One quick question on that. Do you think it would have been easier to have initially started on the equity side and then picked up the debt side? Or do you think that knowing and covering the debt side and particularly structuring deals, that's often one of the more complex areas. Did that then allow you to more easily pick up the equity side?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, I didn't really choose to start on the debt side. Someone chose me. I needed a JOB out of school and Bank of America gave me one. So I started on the debt side. I will say that I think understanding cash flows, understanding risk reward was really important in my development as a commercial real estate. Some people call me an expert. I don't like to use that term. It sets the bar way, way too high. I feel like my dad's an expert and I'm just like a random walk through commercial real estate. But I think it taught me a lot about cash flow. And that was super, super important. The transition from debt to equity was simultaneously hard and really invigorating at the same time. So let me explain what that means. It took me a long time to figure out that, and this is going to sound like Captain Obvious stuff, but debt's all about mitigating risks. And equity is all about maximizing growth. And so those are like two sides of the same coin. But what was really invigorating about the equity side of the business is I'd never been an equity analyst before. I didn't know what was status quo, what wasn't status quo. And so Pacing Point, I had always been taught to value bonds based upon DCF. You value properties based upon DCF. And so I just came in and I started valuing stocks on DCF. And that was like really weird at the time, but I think it's become a little bit more consensus way to think about the world. So that's a long way of saying it was actually pretty exciting to come in and have no preconceived notions about how you're supposed to think about the REIT equity side of the business.
So Rich, maybe pivoting a little bit, do you mind giving us an overview of your team, maybe what your current mandate is, what you guys cover?
Yeah. So I am a team of one for about three more days. I am making my first hire. He starts on Monday. So I'm super excited about that. It was sort of intentional not to hire anyone for the first 2 years. First of all, because I didn't really know what type of person I needed when I joined Cohen & Steers, and I was still building out a tremendous amount of tools. So I tell people that means 60, 70% of the time, I'm completely fine. The other 30% of the time, I'm drowning and my head's underwater. And I'm at the cusp of like grasping for air. So what do I do? So in a strategy and research, what does that really mean? I define my role into three parts. The first is what I consider to be a real estate advisory business. And so I'm speaking to our institutional clients about where we are in the commercial real estate cycle, how that impacts valuations, and what that means for asset allocation. Classic research analyst, I have a 200-page deck. I don't go into any meeting with a 200-page deck. I usually try to keep it to 30 to 50 pages, but I can always pull from my 200-page deck depending upon what people want to talk about. So that's fun. And my clients vary anywhere from foundations and endowments, some of which are nonprofits, to your classic institutional investors, like pension funds, sovereign wealth funds. It's across the globe. I've spent time in Malaysia. I've spent time in the Middle East. I got back from Australia not too long ago. And of course, I spend a lot of time in the United States as well. So that's the real estate advisory business. The second part of my business is pure investments. I view it as like the internal side of my business. What is that? I help manage the asset allocation for our funds. We have a couple of funds that can invest in listed REITs, fixed income, and private real estate. We're all constantly trying to figure out what's the optimal allocation of listed versus private within those funds. And happy to go through a little bit more detail. But where I've also spent a lot of time is running what we refer to as the red, yellow, green model. Terrible name. I just haven't been able to come up with anything else. What does it do? Well, it identifies what property types and what markets we should be focused on based upon a pure private equity type analysis. What's my unlevered IRR? What's my levered IRR? What's my cash on cash returns? That was a big shift for me when I moved to Cohen & Steers because I hadn't had that unlevered IRR type analysis on a property by property, market by market basis. So that's the investment side. That's the second part. The third part, which I candidly haven't done a really great job over the past 2 years, is where's the world going in the next 5, 10, 15 years? I say I haven't done a really good job of it because I'm still trying to figure out where the world is going in the next 6 to 12 months. I think when we'll talk about this, I think I have a little bit more clarity on that today than I did 12 months ago. But those are my three mandates in a nutshell. And I sort of view it as a Venn diagram, if you will. They all feed off of each other.
Have you been able to bring a lot of the habits or skills from the sell side to the buy side? The red, yellow, green kind of sounds like buy, hold, sell, but maybe it's more of a we like it, we're lukewarm, and let's keep away.
Yeah. So I think you're asking a question about like what did the sell side teach me that I brought to the buy side? The single most important thing was the sell side taught me how to develop a process and a framework. And I didn't recognize how important that is on the buy side. I think a lot of people think about the buy side as this really interesting, fast-moving investment process. Honestly, it's not always that. I describe it, I don't like sports analogies because not everyone gets it, but I will use in a sports analogy here. It's sort of like going out and swinging a tennis racket or hitting a golf ball or going running over and over. You just have to repeat the process over and over and over again because small little details start to weave a story. And if you can connect the dots between those stories, then that starts to become an investment thesis. I would say the process itself and what the sell side taught me about having a framework, doing this, and that creates success, bringing it to the buy side was probably the most impactful for me.
And do you find that you're having similar types of discussions, even though maybe your counterparts are different? And I would expect some are going to be similar, but are you approaching those conversations the same way?
Yeah, I think everyone sort of asks the same questions. And so the markets are different, but everyone wants to understand, where are we in the commercial real estate cycle? How is that impacting valuations? And what does that mean for asset allocation? What's been most eye-opening for me on the buy side versus the sell side is, on the sell side, sometimes I could write research that just explained the what and not the why. On the buy side, everything has to be a why. And if there's a page in my deck that is not important to the why, then it's not important. So everything has to be, okay, fine. Transaction volumes are troughing. Great. What does that mean for property prices? What does that mean for price discovery? What does that mean for where listed REITs are trading, and should we be buying private versus listed? Everything is a why, and everything is, okay, fine. Yeah, you did this great analysis. You unpacked all this information. How does it impact the investment thesis? And it took me a little bit of time to make that jump, if you will, from, okay, fine, this is just the what, to this matters to the investment process, and this is what we should be doing with the data.
And just as a clarification, is that the answering the why, is that turning it into something that's actionable, or yep. Is it?
Okay. Yeah, everything has to be actionable. Sometimes my clients will ask me something that isn't necessarily actionable, but from my perspective, I need to understand, should we be buying listed REITs versus private? Should we be buying listed versus fixed income? And there's a lot of different things that I'm looking at that we can talk through those that help shape that investment thesis. So it's very much, what is the actionable investment thesis and what is the importance of this data point? And if I can't explain that, I either need to do more work or it's not as important to the investment thesis as I thought it was.
So Rich, I guess to set the stage for the rest of our conversation, do you mind giving us an overview of Cohen & Steers and telling us what makes you guys different from some other firms?
Yeah. So we were founded in 1986 by Marty Cohen and Bob Steers. They were actually some of Howard Marks's first hires when Howard was still on the sell side. I think we're often considered to be one of the grandparents of the modern listed REIT market. So they created actively managed mutual funds. Timing was very good in retrospect. 86 was a great time to be investing in commercial real estate, but the company probably wasn't so well founded that it couldn't be nimble and take advantage of what was happening in the coming years with the S&L crisis. So they really caught lightning in a bottle in the early 1990s as the commercial real estate market began to become institutionalized on the other side of the S&L crisis. So I think most of people know us as a very large manager of listed REITs. We probably have around 40% market share of actively managed listed REITs. That's a lot. But today we manage, give or take, $85 billion. That's not all of what we do. It's still a big portion of it, but I like to consider us an alternative manager focused on real assets. Real estate's a big portion of that, but it also includes things like infrastructure, includes things like commodities. We have a very big fixed income business, particularly in preferreds, but also in REIT debt. We do pre-IPO stuff. So we do a lot of different things in a lot of different funds. And where I'm spending increasing amount of my time is on the private real estate side of our business. It is a new business for Cohen & Steers, as in the last several years. And look, we're building out that business. We don't manage billions of dollars at this point, but you should think about us as an alternative manager focused on real assets, not just real estate, but real estate is a big portion of what we do.
And I would think that the comments you had around focusing on DCF and understanding cash flows, that's probably a unifying theme across all the real assets, even though you're probably using different timelines in terms of, not all of them are 10-year DCFs.
Yeah, hey, look, I like to tell people real estate is not rocket science at the end of the day. It's just a cash flow business. What are you buying something for? How much cash flow are you getting? How much money do you have to spend to generate that cash flow? How much debt you can put on it? And what are you selling it for in the future? If you can figure out those variables, that's easier said than done. But if you can figure out those variables, you can figure out what your unlevered IRR is.
And turning attention to the macro landscape, what's your view of the current macro environment?
Yeah. So I'm going to focus my views on commercial real estate macro. I think there's probably a lot of people smarter than me on macro, and I'm not sure any of those people really know what's happening right now. Call me tomorrow and it might be a little bit different. So look, this is a fascinating time to be in the commercial real estate market for a number of different reasons. First and foremost, look, we think valuations, unlevered property valuations, are falling 25% peak to trough. They're down around 20, 21% right now. That doesn't happen very often. It's actually only happened twice prior, in the SNL crisis and the GFC. So it's a generational opportunity to acquire private real estate. And I focus on private real estate because I actually think the listed REIT market has already corrected and bottomed. Let me explain that. So listed REITs are trading about 33 percentage points above their October 23 troughs. Why is that important? We're really big believers that listed REITs are leading indicators in both downturns and recoveries. In 2022, they were down 25% when the private real estate market was still up. In 2023, they were up 10% while the private real estate market was down. And as we speak today, they're up again while the private real estate market's down. The listed REIT market is sending you a signal that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. So that leads me to private markets. Private markets usually trough around 12 to 18 months after listed REIT markets trough. We think we're in the midst of the troughing process right now. I think private valuations will trough somewhere between Q3, which we're in right now, to 1Q of 25. I'm not smart enough to tell you where it's going to be in that three-quarter period. I'm pretty comfortable it's going to be in that three-quarter period. But there's another important point here that I'm sure we can expand upon a little bit, but debt markets, distress in the debt markets, usually peaks out around 12 to 18 months after private valuations trough. So there's just a process, and it's almost like a grieving process. And my point to you, and I think this is lost on a lot of people, you can simultaneously say that the private real estate markets are in the midst of troughing, and we're still in the very early innings of distress in the debt markets, because that's the way it works. You go back and you think about what happened during the GFC, CMBS delinquencies peaked 2.5 years after private valuations troughed. And you can say, well, Rich, you're just focusing on CMBS. There was a lot of distress there. Sure, but even if you look at life companies, it was a year after property valuations troughed, their delinquency peaked. Banks, the same thing. So it's just this sort of grieving process that you have to get through. And frankly, we sort of look at accelerating distress, rising distress, as a contrarian bullish signal that you should be willing to step in and buy private and listed real estate.
So Rich, what's your view of the capital markets generally? You want to give us an idea of kind of what your current characterization is, maybe what trends you're looking at right now?
Yes. So when I think about capital markets, I automatically think about the lending markets and the transaction markets. And both of these are really important signals right now. So let me break down both of them. Transaction activity in the second quarter of 24 was flat on a year-over-year basis. We haven't seen it be flat in quite some time now, probably 3 years. Now, some of that flat activity had to do with a big private equity firm taking a listed REIT private. But even if you exclude that, valuations were only down 13% year over year, which is sequentially flat to where it was in 1Q. So 1Q was down 13, 2Q was down 13, X this big M&A transaction. That gives me a little bit of confidence. Why is that important? Well, as you see transaction volumes trough, i.e. turn less bad, it usually corresponds to a troughing in year-over-year changes in property valuations. It gives you a signal that the worst is behind us, and we see this playing out again. The second side is what's occurring in the lending markets. Lending conditions are still tightening, not to the degree that they were several quarters ago. So when I talk about lending conditions, I'm really referring to the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey, quarterly survey put out by the Fed. Their last 2Q survey said around 22% of lenders were still tightening. By the way, last quarter, that was around 30%. And at its lows in 2023, it was around 65% of lenders tightening lending conditions. So we've clearly troughed here, and the second derivative has turned positive. That also corresponds to year-over-year changes in property valuations. So we're looking at an environment where I think the worst is behind us. I think transaction volumes have troughed. I think lending conditions are turning less bad. I think appraisal valuations are still falling because they're on a lag. There's a lot of signs to suggest that transaction prices have already peaked out or have already troughed out. I spend a lot of time looking at the Nareef Odyssey Index, which tracks 25 open-ended funds that own core commercial real estate. It looks pretty clear that transaction cap rates peaked out in 1Q. Now they've come in and they're pretty close to where listed REIT implied cap rates are. So I don't want to tell you that this is going to be puppy dogs and rainbows for the commercial real estate market, because it's far from that. But I don't think it's nearly as bad as the media headlines suggest. And I think the worst is clearly behind us.
I guess on that, because I know the media has taken special attention to the banks, and I think it's hard to ignore the banks. If you're looking at the sluice data, that is of banks, and ultimately playing kind of a 40% role in CRE lending. Do you think even if you are anticipating distress to continue to climb, but that's like a normal recovery, even after pricing troughs and starts recovering, do you have a view on the CRE risk within the U.S. banking space?
We could probably speak for hours about this singular topic, but let me make a couple important points. There's a widely thrown stat that small banks finance 70% of commercial mortgages in the United States. That is a half-truth. And it's a bad game of telephone that's occurred. Small banks don't finance 70% of commercial mortgages in the United States. Small banks finance 70% of loans held on bank balance sheets. But you nailed it by saying banks have 40% market share. So if you take 40% market share times 70%, that means small banks finance around 30% of commercial mortgages in the United States. Still a big number, but not 70%. So that's point number one. I think it's really important. The second point here is, let's be clear, there's 4,700 banks across the United States. Guys, I think we would struggle to name more than 25 of them. If you could do whack-a-mole and name 100, I'd probably give you $10. So there's 4,700 banks across the United States. The reason I bring this up is if you would have asked me in March 2023 if there would be 3 or 4 bank failures and that was it, I would have told you you're crazy. So there is going to be more issues with banks in the coming years. I'm surprised it hasn't really occurred yet. Banks fail even in good years. So there is distress coming, but there's an important point here. I think borrowers and lenders are coming to the negotiation table and actually helping to solve the person's dilemma in a way that they hadn't previously. Banks don't want to foreclose on properties because owning that property on balance sheet has a higher regulatory capital charge than actually just modifying, extending a loan at a 99% LTV. So they don't want to do it. They're also selling a lot more loans than they have in the past because it seems like there's more buyers that want to buy big portfolios of loans than they had in the past. But what we haven't really talked about and what isn't getting a lot of attention is why a borrower might not want to default on a loan. And there's a couple different reasons for it. But not everyone has a non-recourse loan where they can just walk away from it. This is a really important point because if you walk away from a loan, guess what? It's considered a capital gain in the eyes of the IRS. That loan forgiveness is considered capital gain, and the IRS wants their taxes on that. So you have a choice. A borrower has a choice. They can either default on their loan and get a 40% tax bill on that loan forgiveness, or they can just inject a little bit more money in. So this is just to say that I think borrowers and lenders are coming to the negotiation table a little bit more than they were during the GFC, and you're not seeing a sudden collapse in the lending markets like everyone feared maybe 12 months ago or so, 18 months ago or so. It just feels not as bad as people were expecting it to be.
Do you anticipate the private credit, so the non-bank space, to pick up meaningfully? Because if the banks aren't necessarily out of it, I think that the reason why private credit's been getting so much attention recently has been because there's this expectation that the banks are either sidelined or it's a shrinking market.
Yeah. So let me preface what I'm about to say that, look, I like credit right now. I think credit is a really interesting part of the capital structure. That said, I don't think share is nearly as high as some might perceive it to be. I don't think private credit share can go much higher than 25 to 30%. There's just not enough lenders of scale to move it 25 to 30%. But that's still a lot of share, right? So yes, banks are going to pull back, particularly small banks. That doesn't necessarily mean small banks are getting out of lending to commercial real estate. I think how they lend to commercial real estate is changing, though. Do I think they're going to lend directly to a property anymore? Probably not. Do I think they're going to lend to someone who lends on commercial real estate? Yeah, I do. So that's maybe the role private smaller banks will start to fill. But you brought up a good point. Yes, banks are pulling back, particularly smaller banks. But guess who's having a field day right now? Life insurance companies. Life insurance companies are finally able to lend at yields that make sense to them for the first time in what, like 15 years. And that's a huge portion of life insurance company businesses. They just haven't been able to do it for a long time. This is a classic research answer, But it's not this or that or A or B or X, Y, or Z. It's a little bit of all of it. And the pie is just shifting a little bit more. That's supposed to occur. I've been doing this almost 25 years now, and I've probably been told at least three times in my career, the commercial real estate market's dead. Commercial real estate market doesn't die. It's a microcosm of the U.S. economy. It evolves and it shifts and it changes. And we're at the precipice of one of those really exciting changes.
That's an excellent segue into the next set of questions. Not as a CRE analyst, but looking at the entire portfolio, what role does CRE really play in portfolios?
It's a great question. And the reason I say it's a great question, it's been out of favor for the past 3 years. It's either been in the box or it's a four-letter word. You can use whatever cliche term you want to use. But I believe commercial real estate is beginning to be at the forefront of investors' attention again because volatility is picking up again. You just had Japanese stocks fall, collapse 10, 12, 15% a couple weeks ago. You've seen the Magnificent Seven pull back and then rally. So what does commercial real estate do within a portfolio? It's a great diversifier. It provides stable returns through a combination of income returns and capital returns. And typically, commercial real estate zigs when the broader equity markets are zagging. What I think has confused a lot of people, though, is this idea that commercial real estate is an inflation hedge. I think the last several years has led to some questions if it is an inflation hedge. We absolutely think it's an inflation hedge. The problem is it's not a hedge against stagflation, which is exactly what we've been dealing with over the past couple of years. Stagflation is kryptonite for commercial real estate because it means that financing costs are going a lot higher, interest rates are rising, and at a time that growth is slowing. That just means your levered returns are collapsing on itself. The good news is stagflation doesn't really happen that much. The only time I've seen it in my career was in 1Q of 2005, and it was a head fake. The Economist in 1Q of 05 actually had something on the title of their magazine called Stagflation, if you want to go back and look at that. But prior to that, you have to go back to the 1970s. So yes, commercial real estate is a hedge against inflation. It's just not a hedge against stagflation. Not much is a hedge against stagflation, except really high growth tech stocks and commodities. What does that really mean if I'm trying to be direct with you? I tell people that if you can't explain something, it's really scary. And if you can't explain something, it's a little bit less scary. I think this correction in commercial real estate, whether it be listed REITs or private, is very reasonable. Yeah, 25% decline feels like a huge number, but we're really back to 2019 levels. This has everything to do with repricing the right side of the balance sheet as we go back to an old normal environment. This is not a new normal environment. This is an old normal environment of slightly higher inflation and slightly higher interest rates. And I actually think that will be really good for commercial real estate because you're back to fundamentals and not financial engineering driving valuations.
And one thing that you just mentioned is looking at both private and public. And I know that those often get pitted against each other as if one is right, one is wrong. But how do you think about the difference between private and public real estate investments?
Yeah, when someone asks me, do I like public or private more? My favorite answer is I reject the premise of the question. I'm not sure what that means, but it sounds pretty fancy. Look, I think there's a home for both public and private within portfolios. There are times in which you want to be overweight one versus the other. We happen to think that you're supposed to be overweight listed REITs right now versus private. But that'll change. In a mid-cycle environment, you probably want to own a little bit more private than listed because listed's inherently more volatile over the near term and produces similar returns. So that just means you get better Sharpe ratios owning private in a mid-cycle environment. But there's an important point here that I'm personally spending a lot of time on right now. I don't think people really understand how much of a defensive tool listed REITs can be in a private portfolio. If you just have a 10% allocation of listed REITs, it actually increases your returns and reduces your volatility. Really weird that I'm saying it reduces your volatility when listed REITs are inherently more volatile. It's because the zigging versus zagging nature. So what it ends up doing is it smooths out your returns over time, reduces your drawdown risk. It's a really great diversifier within portfolios if you can actually just look through all the noise and think about it as a singular commercial real estate allocation with 10, 20, 30% allocation of listed and the rest being private. So we like both of them. We think there's a home for both of them. I would challenge any of your listeners when someone says, I like listed and I don't like private, or I like private and I don't like listed. That seems like they're talking their book a little bit because there's a home for both in portfolios.
And with that, that means that real estate should not just be looked at as a bond proxy or some sort of other fixed income. Is that correct?
Yeah, look, it has bond attributes, but it also has equity attributes as well. I come back to the point I made previously. The reason you get attractive total returns in the commercial real estate market is by a combination of current income and appreciation. So I don't think it's just a bond proxy. To be very clear, the correlations to real rates right now are very high. And the market is trading real estate, particularly listed real estate, based upon the probability of interest rates cuts and the magnitude of those interest rate cuts. That makes sense near term because the markets can be pretty emotional. It doesn't make sense medium to long term. You know, what impacts commercial real estate medium to long term? We think it's real rates, but it's a combination of nominal inflation. We think it's credit spreads given the debt components. We think it's net operating income growth. That explains around 70% of valuations. And then there's about five other factors that get your adjusted R squared, to use a really wonky term, up to around 80% or so. There's a lot of other factors than just the level of interest rates that impact valuations. And I think once we get past all of this uncertainty, you're going to start to see a less volatile asset class.
Rich, I guess getting away from CRE as a piece of a portfolio and more towards your characterization of CRE generally, you said that private real estate is a relatively new business to Cohen & Steers in the last few years. What are the themes that you're looking at? This could be about fundraising, structuring. What are some of the things that are going on there?
Yeah. Okay. So important question. We've been talking about commercial real estate as if it's a singular asset class. In reality, it's 18 different subsectors that fall under this umbrella. So guess what? Things like data centers and cell towers and seniors housing and single family rentals can be doing really well when things like office are not doing as well. So that's the first point. We need to start thinking about commercial real estate as 18 different subsectors under a broad umbrella. But this leads me to point 1B. Many people think about commercial real estate as an old economy asset class based upon the main food groups of retail, office, industrial, hotel. That's not really true. It's become a new economy asset class. Around 60% of listed REIT market cap is what we consider to be next generation property types. Things like data centers, things like cell towers, things like seniors housing, single family rentals. I can go on and on. Cold storage has become a huge asset class. There was just the largest IPO of the year was actually a REIT, believe it or not. I don't know the last time if you could ever say that before. That's a pretty remarkable statement. So I think where you invest your money, there's a wide opportunity set. What are we spending time on? Look, we're trying to figure out where the best bang for our buck is on an unlevered and levered IRR basis. We think that happens to be open air shopping centers right now. We sort of like barbelling grocery store anchored shopping centers with what we refer to as community centers. Community centers are things backed by Lowe's, Home Depot, Walmarts, things like that. Those combinations create a really interesting return profile. Retail has been out of favor for a long time. You may have heard of the retail apocalypse prior to COVID. There's still a lot of investors that have retail redlined and they can't invest in it. You end up having these really relatively wide cap rates on super strong fundamentals because guess what? No one's been dumb enough to build a retail property over the past 15 years. And then you had this great Darwinistic event during COVID. So we like open air shopping centers a lot. That's where we're spending most of our time. We're closely watching the multifamily market. It looks like cap rates have settled in the low 5% range. We think there will be opportunities as the debt markets begin to shake out over the coming, call it 12 to 18 months. We think there will be some select opportunities higher than that, call it the high fives or low sixes. Maybe we're wrong there, but we're sort of biding our time a little bit more. I'd like to tell you what we're buying office. I do think that there is some really interesting office properties, interesting valuations. Guys, it is hard to raise capital on office right now. It's not for the faint of heart. I was seeing an investor in the Midwest not too long ago, and I was walking through my office thesis saying there's some really interesting opportunities, and they sort of agreed. And I said, what happens if I show up tomorrow with a fund that's 30% office? Will you take a meeting? And the response was, no, we won't. So that sort of tells you where it is. And maybe our biggest out of consensus view is on industrial. We just don't like it. Not because it's not a great asset class. It is. We just think the long-term terminal growth that's being factored into where valuations are still trading, it's too high. And it will still prove to be best in class over the long term, but it's going to normalize much lower as supply versus demand balances out. And the final thing I would tell you is I spend just a tremendous amount of time on markets. What I'm trying to find is markets that I think are experiencing transformational economic booms. What does that mean? Well, it means markets that are actually going through something economically that is leading to a step function higher in its economy. I'll give you some examples. Like Northwest Arkansas right now is absolutely booming. Chattanooga, Tennessee, Knoxville, Tennessee, Fort Walton Beach, Greenville, South Carolina. There's all these really cool markets that people actually live in and young people live in there. And by the way, they're seeing a tremendous amount of tech innovation because of the CHIPS Act, for instance. Savannah, Georgia is a great example of this. So I'm trying to find those markets that are smaller markets. Institutional investors probably aren't going to as much. And we can be what I refer to as a big fish in a small pond.
We're coming toward the end of earnings season here. I'm sure you've been paying attention to some calls. What were some of the themes that you took from those in the second quarter earnings?
Yeah, I try not to be a single name stock analyst as much as I used to be. I still wake up in cold sweats getting yelled at by management teams for downgrading a company or what have you. So here's the most interesting thing. Fundamentals are actually holding up really well in aggregate. So net operating income growth, that's what I refer to when I talk about fundamentals. You know, it's around 4% right now, maybe a little bit less. That is much lower than where it was at the peak post-COVID when it was at 10, 11, 12%. But that 4% is still really good. Historically, net operating income growth is in the 2.5% to 3% range. And in environments where commercial real estate valuations are down 20 to 30%, usually it's negative 5 to negative 10. Today, it's positive 4. Why is that occurring? I think there's one thing that the market's really missing, or the casual investor's really missing. There's a positive impact from inflation as well. The positive impact is it's really hard to build things. Guess what? Financing costs are high. Construction costs are high. Raw material costs are high. Labor costs are high. So you have some pockets of supply like the multifamily market, but supply is going to fall off a cliff here in the next 12 to 24 months. And that's going to be a great safety net for how much commercial real estate fundamentals can decline. Because usually commercial real estate fundamentals go negative when there's a supply shock. And there isn't a supply shock this time around. So I think fundamentals are really good, at least in the listed REIT market. Balance sheets are really clean. LTVs in aggregate are around 35% or so. Guess what? 90% of their debt's fixed for a term of around 6 years or so. So rising interest rates will have a little bit of an impact on earnings, but not a huge impact. Final point I would make to you here, it's been a long time since listed REITs started to go on the offensive and acquire properties. Why is that the case? Well, the public markets force discipline on the listed REIT markets. As cycles mature and valuations get higher, public markets say, I'm not giving you a cheap cost of capital, and therefore you can't go buy properties. But something really funny happens historically at the beginning of cycles. And you saw this in the early 2000s, and you saw it during the GFC. Listed REITs start trading at pretty significant premiums to net asset value. Net asset value is a fancy way of saying the value of a commercial real estate property. When that happens, the public markets are saying, we're giving you an attractive cost of capital to begin acquiring properties. I think you're going to start to see them go on the offensive. I think you're going to start to see them net acquire properties for maybe the first time in 15 years.
That's something I certainly heard on a few of those calls. I'm not super surprised to hear that either. But I got one more for you here, and that's we're only in August, and that means we got 3 or 4 months left in the year. What are some themes you're watching, not just in listed REITs, but across the CRE market?
Yeah. So I think this is maybe a good summary of what we talked about. First of all, I am looking for rising distress. I see it as a complete contrarian bullish signal that you can begin investing in commercial real estate. And by the way, guess what? Distress has only one way to go because there's been very little distress in the market so far. So distress is rising. Media headlines are going to be awful over the next 18 to 24 months. But everyone should think about that as a contrarian bullish signal. Looking at transaction volumes, I want to see transaction volumes continue to stabilize at these levels. I think there's a really good chance that lending conditions might start to loosen in the next couple quarters. And maybe more importantly, I know this sounds really silly and Captain Obvious stuff, but the minute property valuations start to rise, not on just a total return basis, but on an unlevered price basis, that's a huge signal. And I think it starts to put a lot of the headwinds that we're talking about behind us. So those are the things that I'm really looking for. I actually think commercial real estate can do okay, at least on a relative basis in a hard landing scenario. I think a soft landing scenario is great. What I'm really concerned about is just a reacceleration in inflation. That seems like less of a concern today than it was 3 or 6 months ago. But really what I'm looking for is just a continuation of the themes that we've seen. This cycle's playing out sort of like the way I expected it to. And I just want to continue to see no surprises. And so, knock on wood, so far so good.
Shifting away from talking markets and specifically CRE and turning attention to really the role of research, how do you see the role of buy-side CRE investment research changing?
Yeah, got to figure out how to answer this question without patting myself on the back and talking my own book here. Look, I first of all think being a good research analyst is hard because it takes this weird combination of being a dork and liking to go in your think tank and come up with really interesting ideas by doing research. That's what it is. But you also have to be a great communicator and you got to like doing it. You got to like doing things like this, having conversations with people like yourself and explaining in a really succinct way, both verbally and written, like how the market's working. So I think there's a lot of research people that are great researchers that might not like to explain it in an easy way. And there's some people that like to explain it, but don't like to do the research part of it. That's all to say that I actually think research is becoming even more important in the investment process, but maybe not for the reasons you think. I spend a lot of time with investors just being objective and transparent and data-driven. And I'm coming in, my view is I'm not selling you anything. I'm just trying to create credibility and establish a mutual understanding of how we view the world. And if you can just be objective and data-driven, it's okay to say valuations are going to be down 25 to 30% if you think they're going to be down 25 to 30%. I think people really respect that. And so to have an objective, data-driven approach, it's just invaluable. I come back to the point I made maybe midway through. If you can explain something, it's less scary. If you can't explain something, it's really scary. I spend just a tremendous amount of my time, number one, doing the mundane, updating data on a monthly basis, whenever new data comes out, trying to figure out, trying to connect the dots, then trying to say in the most efficient way possible, what is the story today? And then trying to explain that in a very crisp manner. So in many respects, I think it's a lost art. I promised I wasn't going to try to pat myself on the back, but I just did. But I guess if you don't think highly of yourself, no one else will. So hopefully that's a good answer. I think it's becoming really important. I think it will become even more important as big data, AI, alternative data sources, all of which we use, help advance the research process.
So you think AI is real? Yeah.
Really interesting question. And this might be a loaded question. I think it will be real. When I hear someone saying we fully integrated AI into our research and investment process, I don't really know what that means. I don't think AI is that good yet to be able to tell you where rent growth is going, where property valuations are going. I tend to spend a lot of time on alternative data sources and automating those alternative data sources as much as possible. Is that AI? I don't know if it is or it isn't, but I like to use alternative data sources that give me a unique view of what properties we should be in, what markets we should be in. I do think AI in 5 or 10 years is going to be very real. I question a little bit if it's truly driving investment decision processes as much as someone might say it is today.
And do you think that's because those that are in the CRE investment research space don't know how to use AI, or because there are no easy kind of ways to apply it?
I define AI right now as if you know how to use it, it makes someone exponentially more efficient at their job. But I don't think it suddenly replaces them as an analyst. So if there's times in which I use AI and work with one of our quants, it will make me way more efficient. But I don't think it's necessarily going to be replacing a job. I think the biggest debate with AI is what it's going to do to the middle class. I think there is a chance that it actually helps the middle class because our economy has become such an export-driven economy over the past 10, 20, 30 years where only experts were excelling. Now, suddenly, if you could put AI in the hands of the middle class and it's the great equalizer, maybe it actually brings back the middle class in the United States. Not a political statement by any means, just things that I'm thinking about.
I would love to have like a 2-hour conversation on that, but I'm not sure we have the podcast time for that.
We do only have a few more minutes. So, Rich, I'm going to ask you the question we ask all of our guests. And that is, if you could snap your fingers and have a change to the CRE industry come true, what would that be? Could be anything.
Oh, this is easy. Research analysts get paid more money. Look, if I had to snap my fingers, I would love it to be less of a boom and bust market. That scares people. But every 10 to 15 years, we get a pullback in valuations where they're 20 to 30% lower. I think that ends up providing a generational opportunity to create best-in-class vintage returns. But ultimately what I'm saying, and I'm making fun of myself here, I promise, I'm not making fun of anyone listening or I'm not making fun of you guys. Commercial real estate market does a really bad job of buying low and selling high. Why do I say that? Commercial real estate investors, they all believe tomorrow is going to be better than today. So they like to buy everything when it feels really good and sell everything when it feels really bad. We're trying to do the opposite of Cohen and Steers. We're trying to be really disciplined and we're trying to sell when it feels really good and buy when it feels really bad, because that's when you make really great returns.
Excellent answer. I love that. But Rich, thank you so much for joining us. I think we're right up on time. I really appreciate the conversation. I think you covered everything we wanted to talk about today. Really appreciate it. But Omar, I think that's all the time we've got. So I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one, guys.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.